Hello, I'm Sonia Rothwell. It's Monday, March the 9th, and in today's podcast, Sinn Féin vows the peace process will continue despite the murders of two British soldiers in Ulster at the weekend.
It's not only an attack on the peace process, it's an attack on the entire political process.
Sex, power, and a sect run by a second-hand car salesman. Germany's latest scandal has it all.
Munich courtroom today is going to hear the details of a Swiss playboy who seduced Germany's richest woman.
And we reveal the big-hitting lineup for this year's Guardian Hay Festival. That coming up, but first a look at today's headlines and a flick through the papers.
In a phone call to the Sunday Tribune in Belfast last night, a group declaring itself the Real IRA claimed responsibility for the attack at the Mazarin Army base. Two soldiers were killed and four people injured. They were the first to be murdered in Northern Ireland since 1997. Sinn Féin's Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness both backed the police's search for the killers and denounced the attack. We'll have more on this story in just a moment. US President Barack Obama is expected to lift restrictions on federal research on stem cells later today. The move comes after former President George W. Bush blocked funds for research on human embryonic stem cell lines. Scientists say the research will lead to medical breakthroughs, but many religious groups are opposed. The policy change is part of President Obama's pledge to make clear that his administration wants scientific research to be free from political interference. Bosses of Lloyds Banking Group are facing calls to resign today as the stock market gives its verdict on the latest multi-billion pound taxpayer bailout. Chairman Sir Victor Blank and Chief Executive Eric Daniels are under pressure from shareholders angered by the rescue deal, which will see the government stake upped from 43% to a controlling interest of at least 65%. Patrick Stewart scooped his third Olivier Award last night for his role as the scheming Claudius in Hamlet. The award was the actor's third Olivier in his career, this time for a supporting role in a production starring David Tennant as Hamlet. Another winner was the National Theatre of Scotland's play Black Watch, which won Best New Play and Best Director. Now let's have a look at the papers. And the Independent leads with the government's drive to tackle white-collar unemployment as the toll of job losses among managers and executives rises. The Work and Pensions Secretary James Purnell said from next month professionals signing on will get special help in how to look for work. The Express says that researchers in London have come a step closer to discovering a cure for cancer. In a radical departure, the research concentrated not on stopping the formation of tumours, but on singling out the enzyme allowing cancer cells to spread throughout the body. The FT has an interview with President Obama's adviser Lawrence Summers, urging world leaders to pump more public money into the economy to boost demand. And The Sun has a picture of Arsenal star Eduardo's goal against Burnley, which took them through to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup yesterday. And there's more news and breaking stories throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Former political enemies in Northern Ireland have joined forces to condemn the killings of two British soldiers at an army base in County Antrim over the weekend. Gordon Brown called the shootings evil and cowardly, while the Northern Irish Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness vowed there would be no surrender to groups who are hostile to the peace process. The killings are the first terrorist murders of British soldiers in the province for over a decade. The Guardian's Henry MacDonald is in County Antrim.
At around 20 to 10 on Saturday night, the front of the Mazarine Army barracks was raked with machine gun fire. A number of people were injured, including two British soldiers who were very badly wounded. Then we had a pizza delivery man who was also very badly wounded. Two gunmen then left the vehicle from which the gunfire had came, and they sprayed the two wounded soldiers who were on the ground with more bullets, killing them. So it was a very planned major attack on a British Army base in Antrim town, north of Belfast. The indication is that this was as a result of intelligence gathering by terrorists on the movements at the base. I think it was much more of an opportunistic killing than any inside intelligence.
We think that it's the Real IRA who's responsible. What indications are there that it is the Real IRA?
It's difficult to say because there are several factions who are sometimes interlinked. There's the Real IRA, the Continuity IRA, and a group called Oglan Éireann, and neither. The latter are a much more rural organisation and wouldn't have the logistical base that in the greater Belfast, or Antrim is basically a satellite town of Belfast. So you're talking probably in all likelihood of the Real IRA, but it's difficult to be exact because these organisations are fluid, interrelated, and often, you know, crisscross.
What in the particular political climate has led to this attack happening now?
Well, I think the dissident Irish Republicans have a campaign to destabilise the political settlement in Northern Ireland. They have been trying this for some time. They've been trying to assassinate police officers. They've been trying to explode bombs to kill British soldiers and policemen. So this is part of their strategy. It's about creating enough destabilisation to bring down the power-sharing coalition between Unionists and Nationalists in Belfast.
Now, Gerry Adams has called this an attack on the peace process.
It's not only an attack on the peace process, it's an attack on the entire political process. The dissidents regard the current arrangement at Stormont as a, quote, sellout of Republican values. They think it is copper fastening the partition of Ireland, the creation, the continued existence of two states, Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. This is part of their strategy. It is the most successful, from the dissidents' viewpoint, attack they've mounted, I'd say, in the last decade.
What's been the reaction of the community to this incident?
Well, one demonstration of public outrage has been people went to Mass at the local Catholic church on Sunday morning, and after Mass, they went from their church, which is facing the barracks, facing where the incident took place, and they went out to pray and to express their sympathies en masse for the victims. So that is just a small but significant example of how everyone in the community, including people from the nationalist community, view this attack. They view it indeed as an attack on the peace process.
Henry MacDonald. And you can read more analysis on that story at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. The government's plans to sell off part of Royal Mail have taken a hit after revelations that the service's chief executive is at war with the company that's favourite to take a stake in the business. In an email seen by The Guardian, Adam Crozier demands the government takes action against the Dutch company TNT, which it says is poaching its business. The Guardian's James Robinson has been unravelling the row.
What has happened is Adam Crozier, the Royal Mail's chief executive, has written to the government to complain about the behaviour of TNT. Now, TNT is a Dutch parcel company which has been lined up, we think, to take a 30% stake in the Royal Mail. Now, Crozier is saying that TNT is approaching its customers in Europe. What the Royal Mail has a subsidiary called General Logistics Services, GLS, which is a very valuable part of the business and is not going to form part of the privatisation process. He is saying in his email to the government that TNS and its chief executive directly, Peter Baker, is calling up their customers and encouraging them to leave GLS, its European arm, and go to TNT instead, which is a fairly serious allegation and one the government is apparently taking seriously. So it begs the question, if TNT are about to take a stake in the Royal Mail, as we believe they are, how can the two companies work together when Crozier, the Royal Mail, is accusing TNT of essentially malpractice? So that's what the row is about.
Now, you've seen these emails. I imagine that Adam Crozier's tone is pretty miffed.
Yeah, he sounds extremely upset and very angry. He says, he makes this accusation and points out that GLS is a valuable part of the business, General Logistics Services, and it asks the government to intervene, contact TNT in some way and tell them to back off. And it even implies in the email that he may be suggesting that TNT should be thrown out of the bidding process as a result of this behaviour. It's worth pointing out that TNT deny this completely, of course, but the fact that Crozier has said this to the government is extremely interesting, potentially very significant, I think.
So what do you think the political repercussions would be for it?
It's quite possible that TNT, which is the only company that's, I think, that's come out and said openly that we would like to buy a stake in the Royal Mail, could find its bid to do that has been damaged, perhaps beyond repair. There were other allegations this weekend about TNT's past activities, claims that it, which it admits, that it had some of its workers had forged documents 5 or 6 years ago. And although that was public knowledge already, the fact it's been brought up now does reputational damage to the TNT. And I think all of those people, the many MPs and post office workers who are opposed to the whole idea of selling a stake in the Royal Mail, will seize on this and use it to try and derail the whole process, really.
James Robinson. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, where most people live off less than $2 a day. The country has suffered decades of political instability as well as a succession of humanitarian disasters. But it's the girls and young women living in the gang-ridden slums in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, who have been suffering in this political turmoil. Rape is widespread, and increasingly, it's girls under 18 who are becoming the main target, mostly by groups of armed men intent on ruling the lawless slums with violence. Xantha Hinshi has been to the slums, which are crippled by poverty, to talk to girls who live in daily fear of sexual abuse. Some people may find the contents of her report distressing.
Mary Jane is a shy and skinny 16-year-old. She stares straight ahead when she tells me what happened to her at the hands of a gang in her neighbourhood when she was 12.
The first time, it was the whole gang who raped me. All three of them raped me. Afterwards, my mum took me to hospital and I had to be sewed. That's how bad it was.
2 years later, a man from the same gang raped her again.
The second time, I was on my way to buy water for my mother. On the way there, a man called Jean grabbed me and said he would rape me. As soon as he said that, I ran. But he ran after me, and he caught me, and he raped me. I'd been making T-shirts with a pair of scissors, and after he raped me, he was still holding on to me, and he hit me. But I still had the scissors in my hands. I tried everything to get away, but he didn't want to let me go, so I pushed the scissors into his stomach.
The man died. Mary Jane says that same night, the man's gang then tried to kill her and burnt down her family's home. The next day, she was arrested and imprisoned for 2 years. On the outskirts of Martesson, a notoriously violent slum in Port-au-Prince, is the city's only drop-in rape crisis centre, SOFA. It's a run-down, two-storey building on a quiet back street. Jeanette is one of just seven volunteers. She says they see scores of rape cases every month, and girls being raped by armed gangs is common. But Jeanette also says that most rapes go unreported because justice is expensive and victims are too scared of the gangs. Miriam Marlette heads the government's Ministry of Women. She blames the rape epidemic in Haiti's slums on the political turmoil that has stained the country since the Duvalier family dictatorship was ousted.
Rape has been used as a political weapon in this country since 1986. The soldiers in the army used rape to punish people. Pro-Aristide gangs used rape to control the population. Now the street gangs in the slums use rape as a powerful weapon of war. There's a state absence in the slums, so the gangs have full power to terrorise people as they wish.
Haiti's biggest slum, Cité Soleil, has been described by the United Nations as the most dangerous place on earth. Every few blocks is ruled by a rival gang. At night, there are no lights, and I was only able to visit under the protection of a heavily armed UN patrol. But Haitian girls don't have this protection. Rape was only made a criminal offence in Haiti in 2005. Before then, a judge would negotiate a sum of money to be paid to the victim's family. But despite the new law, the prosecution rate for rape still remains low. Haiti Anabi, the head of the UN mission in Haiti, blames the country's weak justice system.
We're working to ensure that those who are arrested can be processed through the courts. That has been a big problem. About 90% of the people in the prisons are people who have not been sentenced or judged. So it's important also to get those who are accused of serious crimes, to get them before a court and get them sentenced so that the message starts spreading that impunity is no longer assured.
Mary Jane is now out of prison and is angry with the lack of justice in Haiti. She also continues to live with the daily fear of being raped.
I should never have been sent to jail because I was a victim several times over. I don't feel that I'm living now, because if someone's not free, that person will never feel good. I want to live with my mother, but I'm not allowed to, because the gang could find me and hurt me. I have to keep watching. I have to keep watching all the time.
Xantha Hinchey in Haiti. And you can see the film of her report, Haiti's Lost Girls, at guardian.co.uk/world. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website, green is the new most popular colour for weddings in the credit crunch, apparently, as more couples plump for an eco-friendly big day. guardian.co.uk/environment. Follow The Guardian's tips on how to understand people in our special series, guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle. And if you're worried about the recession, why not sign up for some free therapy? Find out more at guardian.co.uk/politics. Coming up, find out who'll be treading the hallowed turf of hay at this year's Guardian Festival. But first, she's the richest woman in Germany, and he's the Swiss opportunist playboy who tried to bribe her. The German press are calling it the case of the gigolo and the billionaires. The court case is due to start today, involving the heiress to the BMW empire and a man who's allegedly extorted millions of euros from wealthy women across Europe. Berlin correspondent Kate Connolly has been following the story for Guardian Daily.
Munich courtroom today is going to hear the details of a Swiss playboy, a case of a Swiss playboy who seduced Germany's richest woman, defrauded her of millions of euros and tried to blackmail her of millions more by revealing details of sexual encounters they had had. This man is called Helge Skarby. He's 44. And he is charged of trying to blackmail Susanna Klatten, the billionaire heiress of BMW, the car maker, who is the 55th richest person in the world. When police arrested Skarby, they also discovered in their subsequent investigations that he had blackmailed a string of rich women across Europe. Klatten, of course, was his biggest conquest.
Now, he's extorted, or is alleged to have extorted, quite a lot of money from Susanna. How much does the total run to?
He got 7 million euros that she handed over to him in a cardboard box in a garage of a hotel in Munich. She described to police how she'd given him 14,500 euro notes wrapped in plastic. This was after Skarby, who she had fallen for, having met him at an exclusive health resort in Austria, had told her that he had run over a little girl in Florida in a car crash, and he needed money to pay off the family. If she could lend him 7 million euros, he would give it back to her at some point. And she fell for this story and handed over the money. And from what we understand, from what Klatten told police subsequently, he then thought he was onto quite a good thing, then asked her to pay him 49 million more. But she then backed down and said that she was not going to fall for this, and she broke off the relationship, whereupon he said that he would publish or go to the board of BMW and to her husband and to the press with compromising film footage that he had shot of an encounter they had had in a Munich hotel.
Like you said, she's not the first of high-profile rich women across Europe that this man's managed to con, is she?
No, we believe there are probably about six other women of some quite extraordinary cases and some quite eccentric characters involved in this. Probably the most interesting or eccentric one was a countess, Countess Verena de Pasquier-Goebbels, who owned a chateau on the bank of Lake Geneva. She was 50 years his senior. He proposed marriage to her. She went off and even bought the wedding rings. She has since died, but she's typical of some of the other rich women that we believe that he also tried to blackmail. And he certainly got quite a lot of money from most of them.
I think the most intriguing element of this is what he wanted the money for.
Well, this is it, and this is going to be very interesting to see if this actually comes out in the Munich courtroom this week. Basically, it is believed by German investigators that Skarby did not actually profit himself from the money he gained. Rather, he was handing it over to what has been described as a pseudo-Catholic sect in Abruzzo, Italy, run by a former second-hand car salesman who claims to have healing powers, and that he actually was working with Scarby, and Scarby basically handed the money over to him. Police have said that Scarby owned a battered second-hand car and lived in a one-room flat in Switzerland. So there was no suggestion that he really was sort of gaining from this money himself. The question is whether these details will come out in court, because the head of the sect has so far escaped justice.
Berlin correspondent Kate Connolly. The lineup for this year's Guardian Hay Festival has been unveiled, with some big names on the bill, as well as national treasures. Everyone from an international prosecutor to world-famous musicians are due to attend. The Guardian's chief arts writer, Charlotte Higgins, has more details.
The really big names at this year's festival, I think the ones that people are going to be queuing up to go and see, are Alan Bennett, I think, in particular, who obviously, you know, the nation's favourite writer, one could almost say, and he will sell out within minutes. So if anyone wants to go and see him, be sure to book your ticket today, Monday. Other fantastic names. Well, there's a great lineup of really excellent sort of mid-career British women writers who seem to be the sort of dominant force in fiction at the moment. So we've got people like Zoe Heller, Kate Atkinson, Sarah Waters, huge favourite of mine, Hilary Mantel. So that looks like being a huge treat. And, of course, one of the characteristics of Hay Festival is that it's always been more than a festival, a literary festival, purely and simply. It's a festival of ideas. And so there are some really interesting people from the wider world of intellectual life. Nicholas Stern, the author of the Stern Report, is going to be speaking. I think a fascinating one will be Luis Moreno Ocampo, the prosecutor from the International Criminal Court. And that should be brilliant.
Do you you mentioned before that there's a lot of women writers, especially British women writers, who are coming to the fore now. Do you think that the festival is predicting these trends by having these women on the, I suppose, timetable?
Yes, I mean, I think festivals like this tend to throw up literary trends almost by chance, because, and sometimes by design. I mean, I suspect that what happens with Hay is that they book the people whom they think are most interesting without necessarily thinking, goodness, we're nailing a trend here. And then the trends kind of emerge as you look through the programme. And it just feels like this year there are a lot of really interesting women writers with books out. And in fact, none of those sort of senior statesmen, literary figures like Martin Amis and Julian Barnes, and are in evidence at all at the festival this year. So that the real kind of senior literary figures are these rather brilliant women.
You mentioned the fact that Hay is a festival of ideas rather than a festival of literature. So you've got a lot of people who work in other media. You've got some television writers who are coming, because that's often overlooked as a genre, isn't it? But there are some pretty outstanding television writers around at the moment.
Yeah, the festival takes the written word in all its forms, really, whether that's journalism, playwriting, screenwriting. And this year, the big name in that sort of area is undoubtedly David Simon, creator of The Wire, which I'm pretty certain is The Guardian's favourite television series. It's certainly one of my favourite television series, and I am super excited about it. So, yeah, fans of The Wire, book quickly. I'm sure that's going to be a real hit.
Finally, if people do want to go along to Hay to see all those things, how do they find out more? How do they get tickets?
Well, the best thing to do is to go to their website, which is hayfestival.com. Three events are going on sale on Monday, today, Monday, which are Alan Bennett, Hugh Masekela in concert, and Tony Curtis. The remaining events will go on sale at the beginning of April, so people should register on the website to be alerted to the moment when the programme is fully unveiled.
Charlotte Higgins. That's all from Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's podcast will be available to download from 7 a.m. Today's producers were Roxanne Escobarlis and Ian Chambers. I'm Sonia Rothwell. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.